I'm delighted to introduce you to our newest supporting sponsor, a team human enabler in more ways than one, Groucho. Groucho's a platform that answers the most common question we get at Team Human: how do I find the others? Well, this is it. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman, share your interests and aspirations, and Groucho's curators will hand assemble a real dinner club for you. You meet twice a month in order to establish some lasting friendships. Groucho takes care of all the logistics. The thing I like is that it was built by artists, not tech pros, people who wanted to recreate what they got from artist residencies, curated intentionally, and with time and space to connect. That's how the founders met their own best collaborators, friends, and even life partners. So check out mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to talk plainly about how fantasies in the machine can provoke real violence on the ground. In the face of tech utopia, can we even just mitigate real-world harm? Let's find out. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, one of the most consequential internet accountability journalists I've ever read, Kat Tenbarge. She's built her reputation exposing platform and influencer harm at Business Insider and NBC News, then launched Spitfire News as a reader-funded feminist newsletter after NBC laid off 40 or so staffers in early 2025. And I, for one, think we're all better for it.
I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, I did columns for things, but I never took a gig at a place. I always felt like their franchise isn't worth me spending my franchise. You know, it was kind of selfish in a way, but it was just like, fuck it. They're using all my stuff and it's all going to their name and their legacy and long-term value and not mine. But also the control, I can't imagine. I mean, was your mom like unhappy when that happened?
I would say yes, but they've come around.
Oh, good. Good. I know. It's like telling your parents, no, I want to leave Harvard to go to, some weird liberal arts school, right? So I guess I want to start with what's just happening. After I wrote Team Human, I got invited to go on Bannon's show, that podcast. And I was really confused, right? Because it was like the Bannon show was happening at the same time that this Italian prime minister started quoting stuff about people and technology. And I was like, wow, is the far right going to be better for this? And I did meet this young guy, a fan, Joe Allen, who works with Bannon on War Room, or did. And listening to them, I'm here with Team Human, and they're here with, what is it, Humans First. Yeah. And I'm like, what? So what's the deal? Do we want, I'm asking you, I'm almost like I'm talking to a rabbi, right? It's like, are they on our side enough that we should be in a coalition with them against like Sam Altman and big tech? Or is it kind of like the Jews siding with the Christian Zionists just long enough to get clobbered themselves?
It's such a good question. And I mean, one thing I found very interesting is that you would not know about the Steve Bannon connection unless you'd sort of looked at the group's profiles online. Like, I think a lot of people in the New York City area who went to their town hall last week probably had no idea that Joe Allen or Steve Bannon had any sort of connection to this organization, because it was framed to them as more of a leftist organizing coalition. I found out about it through sort of like the labor organizing groups in New York, because I have like friends and people who are involved with that scene. And so I see the flyer for this town hall online on Eventbrite. It comes my way. And because I cover AI often from a pretty critical perspective, I was like, I should definitely look into this. But When you go to the website, my first question is, of course, like, who's funding this organization? Because this is the type of event that isn't going to happen for free. And online, there's no, on the website itself, there's no information about that funding. So I go to the event. It's in Manhattan's Upper West Side, which is the congressional district where a lot of AI companies are investing millions of dollars into attack ads against a candidate who used to work for Palantir. So that candidate, Alex Borres, in New York's 12th district, he wasn't there. But that's why they chose this symbolic location. And then they have these three leftist organizers who all have backgrounds in like pro-environmental movements, pro-labor movements, and they give this presentation. And I will say, even before the presentation started, the room filled up much quicker and more fully than I imagined it would. There were at least, I think, 50 people there, and they came from seemingly a very diverse range of backgrounds. And so you have these three leftist organizers, they get up in front of the room and they give a presentation sort of about harms related to AI, controversies in the AI space. And one of them, which I will not forget, like raised the point of these AI guys are acting like it's an extinction level threat to humanity. And maybe it is. And then they have us break off into little groups and discuss our feelings about AI with each other, which was very interesting, very informative. And then sort of at the end, they're like, well, our big push here is that we want politicians to pledge not to accept funding from big AI or from big AI's investors. And then they're also supportive of some state legislative efforts, including Ron DeSantis's AI Bill of Rights in Florida. But they didn't linger on that. They mentioned that one time, I believe, during the Q&A segment. And at the back of the room is sitting Joe Allen. So he never stood up, even though he's very involved with the organization. He never stood up. He never spoke to the crowd. I only found out about him being there because I asked one of the organizers about him after the fact. And he was like, oh, he's right over there. So I went over and chatted with him afterwards. But I suspect that a lot of these New Yorkers, some of whom were wearing like Zohran Mamdani hats and T-shirts, probably would be shocked to know that a Steve Bannon War Room correspondent was in the room with them, was sort of like on this, in this group.
But is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, so that would be the argument that they're making, which is that it's a nonpartisan group. It's bringing together people on both sides of the aisle and apolitical people into sort of this fight against AI. Or just like, it was interesting because a lot of them were also like, well, we need to balance the pros of AI with the cons of AI. But it was interesting because it felt to me like they were ultimately funneling people into supporting specific pieces of legislation, and especially that Ron DeSantis legislation, which is a massive like banner on their website.
Right. And the DeSantis legislation, I mean, it's not for the AIs to have rights.
Right.
It's for us to have rights. I mean, because you're a real journalist and you probably read it. Does it have bad things in it?
The thing that I think is concerning about DeSantis's AI Bill of Rights is that it would require any child under the age of 18 to get a parent's permission before they'd be able to use a chatbot. So a lot of critics of this have argued this is basically another way to implement age verification. And critics of age verification are concerned about the privacy implications, the data security implications. And then, of course, a lot of age verification systems rely on AI to scan your face. So people are sort of like, is age verification really the solution to these problems?
Right. But I mean, I used to get carded all the time.
Yeah.
You know, get into a bar, get a Playboy magazine, get a pack of cigarettes. You get carded. And because it's in the real world, there's some level of anonymity to it. You know, I know now,
yes,
they, if you buy Sudafed, they even write it down and it goes somewhere. But there was some level of anonymity to it. Once you're going online, is there an anonymous solution to such a problem?
Right. And that was something I asked Joe Allen, was about these concerns around age verification. And he basically said, like, I think he said they were bullshit. And he was like, well, you know, he brought up, you know, you have to have an ID to buy a beer, you have to have an ID to buy a gun, like all of these different things, which is true. I think the concern that a lot of people have is in seeing these patterns that have already emerged where a company will collect a bunch of IDs for age verification, and then that data will be hacked and leaked on the internet.
Right. Or pre-hacked by, you know, Larry Ellison or someone who has the clearance to look in everybody's everything anyway.
Right.
Right. But I mean, where do you look in this? And this is maybe wonky, but where do you look toward a solution in that?
I feel like data privacy is kind of the important component here that I think almost everyone seemingly would be able to agree on, that we should have data privacy, that these companies shouldn't be able to get this information about us to then be able to serve us targeted ads, to then be able to know how old we are. It's funny because a lot of these tech companies already know how old their users are. That's how they serve them the targeted ads in the first place. So I think comprehensive data privacy legislation would be a goal that could actually cause these companies to retain significantly less information about each of us. Versus, you know, these age verification measures would allow these companies to have even more information about all of us. And funnily enough, like, lots of people raised concerns about Palantir at this town hall, but Palantir is creating this type of age verification software. So it's like the concerns, like, about these big tech groups are very warranted, but it seems like these big tech groups are the ones proposing and standing to benefit from a lot of the safety legislation.
Right. I mean, so does the technological solution is more like some kind of a crypto, you know, doubly some two-sided verification PGP kind of thing? Or
I could see that if the companies have competition, then you would have more of an impetus for ones to brand themselves as handling your data better, taking less information in about you, having better practices. But because of the lack of competition, because no one can really stand up to a Meta or a YouTube in some of these functionalities, as of right now, they basically call all the shots. And with some of these laws and even the landmark cases we saw this week, like those $400 million fines against Meta, $1 million, you know, fines for individual users who were affected by these things, I think there's an argument to be made that the legal precedent being set could wipe out a lot of smaller competition if they could be held liable for harms.
Right. Well, that's always the object of the game. I mean, I know, yeah, I saw, what was it, Zuckerberg's face. They showed something to him after the decision. You know, and for people who don't know, a woman who I guess was a teenager, most women were at some point, she sued Facebook the way you would sue a cigarette manufacturer for all the addictive harm that it did to her. And it was in Texas, I guess. And the judge and jury gave her, you know, millions of dollars. And so on the surface, it looks like, oh, look, you know, Facebook's got to give these millions of dollars. But when you think about it, oh, now they've got the perfect excuse to say, oh, well, now that it's so dangerous, we have to do very, very complicated and intrusive, you know, sort of, you know, age verification and an anal probe and an iris
exactly.
scan and everything. It's going to be so, I mean, good for their business in the long run for a few million dollars in a court to get this windfall. And then if they get regulation on top of it, regulation that they can afford and know, I mean, you know, to see like, you know, Zencastr or Riverside or, you know, any of the platforms we actually use pay for the kind of things that the regulators will require, you get your monopoly again.
Exactly. And it is concerning because I think what we've seen with X over the past few years where these alternatives have sprung up, one of them being Blue Sky, one of them being Mastodon. It's like these platforms don't have the same resources to combat or influence these regulations the same way Elon Musk does. Obviously, Elon Musk has the most influence, the most amount of money and resources to direct and steer these things however he wants. And funnily enough, Elon Musk came out against the Humans First group. There were like a few Silicon Valley people on X posting about how it was too liberal of an organization, which is funny. And Elon Musk sort of quote tweeted it and did his typical like, this is disturbing or like concerning shtick. There you can kind of trace, though, back to Elon Musk's own funding, because he was a huge investor for the Future of Life Institute, which sort of had like a secret meeting to organize some of these anti-AI groups. And Humans First, it identifies as a grassroots group, but it was incubated in the Center for AI Safety. So Center for AI Safety has big tech funding of its own, or at least it did in the past. So you can kind of see, and you see that with the child safety advocacy groups as well, they're all dipping into the same pot, which is all of the money that these big tech groups have. And you can see how that influence carries out, even if Elon Musk says he's concerned about what it's doing.
I mean, I can't pretend to know everything, right? So when I see Sunrise Movement, when Ralph Nader, you know, Tristan Harris, for better and for worse, all signing on to it, I'm thinking, aren't those people are doing the due diligence that I don't have time to do? I mean, so it's not, I mean, so we're not saying Humans First is necessarily bad.
Right.
We're just saying it's more complex than it may appear on the surface.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say I have questions about sort of the ultimate goals and directions of the organization. And especially looking at the people who are involved in the group, their earliest campaign stops were in Florida. They did a bunch of different cities in Florida. And some of the speakers who they brought forward are like the co-founder of Women for Trump and like the chair of a Sarasota Republican Party, someone who's high up in that organization. And in theory, like, you need bipartisanship to pass legislation. So in theory, reaching across the aisle, finding common ground could be a good thing. But I also wonder, OK, well, what are their motivations and what are their sort of long-term political goals? And do those actually align with people in New York City who support Zohran Mamdani, who they are now recruiting to be a part of their group?
Right. And he seems interested. I mean, and it's tough, but, you know, my impulse is to move toward temporary alliances and then hope that the time we spend together united against Grok,
right,
you know, will help engender a bit more solidarity. And then they'll realize, oh, you know, brown people don't have to die, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. They get an awakening. They get
yeah,
small, slow awakening. They see, oh, look, there's Mamdani, and he's not trying to kill Jews. What's
right.
that?
Right, right. We hope that their impulses are course corrected by our impulses.
Right, right. As rather than ours being course corrected by theirs. I mean, in a what tech taketh away, it can also giveth back. Think about it. We've handed our social lives over to platforms designed to keep us clicking, not connecting, turned human relationships into follower counts and reaction metrics. Our new favorite sponsor, Groucho, is a corrective. Founded by artists who want to flip the script, instead of atomizing us like a social network, they connect people in real life. Human curators place you in a local club with people who complement your interests and your journey. Share evenings out with your club twice a month until real connections take hold. Then, the people at Groucho place you into a new hand-assembled club for the social fabric to grow. Groucho wasn't built by tech bros, but artists who wanted to recreate the serendipity of their own art residencies, where they found lifelong collaborators, friends, even life partners. So come on, Team Human, let's find the others. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Related story. You're really one of the only journalists I know that sort of mapped the whole, like, distribution, creation, financial web or chain between deep fakes, like deep fake porn, and people actually making money.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a weird. I guess I'm interested in two things. I'm interested in how you do journalism like that in such a cryptic realm. But maybe explain, because it seems on the one hand like a victimless crime, right? Someone's going to make a deep fake of some celebrity, you know, having sex because they want to, you know, pleasure themselves to it. Mm-hmm. Have at it. If someone wants to do that to me, I mean, but they don't is the thing. They don't. Yeah. but they want to do it of not just female celebrities, but people in their worlds, right?
Right. Right. Yes. And the way that I kind of stumbled upon this network is that at the beginning of 2023, we saw this just like massive public awareness of deepfakes that didn't previously exist, traced back to a really interesting incident. Basically, there was this Twitch streamer, this guy who's very popular on this streaming platform, popular with a lot of young people. And he, when they're on Twitch, oftentimes they're broadcasting what's on their computer screen. So like, oh, let me show you what I'm looking at on my desktop right now. So he accidentally, when he put his computer screen, when he broadcasted it, there was a tab going to this website called Mr. Deepfakes. And he was looking at deepfake sexual material of one of his fellow female streamers.
You could see all that on the tab?
I don't think you could see the actual material, but you could see that he had searched for it and that he's watching it. And so this turned into a massive controversy. And unfortunately, what we often see happen as a result of these deepfake controversies is that the amount of people consuming the deepfakes and going to the websites where you can get them and make them skyrockets.
Right.
Which is exactly what happened here. This one isolated Twitch incident just preempted this massive upswing in people going to this website, viewing these videos. And in terms of the trajectory of web traffic, it never came back down. It's only ever climbed since. It's just become more and more and more popular. So as journalists, I and others started looking at this website, Mr. Deepfakes. And after just a few minutes, I realized that you could buy this stuff with Visa and MasterCard, which was shocking because Visa and MasterCard in previous years have come out very strongly against pornography. They removed the ability to use them on websites like Pornhub because of the amount of non-consensual material that was reported to be on those websites. But in this case, the entire concept of the website is non-consensual. And I reached out to women who were in some of these videos, like other streamers and influencers. A lot of them didn't even know that this was happening. So then I stopped reaching out to some of the women because I was like, oh, I'm kind of traumatizing them by exposing them to this material that they wouldn't even have known existed. The issue here is honestly like the lack of control. And that is, for a lot of targets, very, very violating. The other part of it is that particularly as the material grows more sophisticated, you genuinely cannot necessarily tell the difference. And so this in particular affects everyday targets, because with the celebrities, you know that Scarlett Johansson did not actually star in a pornographic video. You know that that's not really Scarlett Johansson. She still doesn't like it, but at least there's not as much of a confusion element there. With some of these cases involving like school children, teenagers, college students, everyday women, there is less of a suspension of disbelief. Or rather, I guess there is a suspension of disbelief because it's like people can look at this material and think it's authentic. And even if they know it's not real, it can then have cascading effects on their well-being and reputation. And of course, with children, it actually is already technically against the law. There have been laws in place since the 90s around computer-generated imagery of minors. So already, this is not something it's not even so much of a legal gray area. It's just something that rarely gets enforced. So that is one of the big issues with the production of this material, is that it often targets teenagers and underage girls. And with adult women too, you see the exact experiences. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has talked about this. As a survivor of sexual violence, she felt re-victimized by seeing herself portrayed in this material. So you see that cost, and you see how there is just such a proliferation of this content, and increasingly it's monetized.
Right. So then you found that Visa and MasterCard are using it. Did they respond or change as a result of your journalism?
They never responded to me, but they the site did have to migrate. So what happened was Mr. Deepfakes shut down, and a lot of these creators who had grown big followings, big deepfake creators, they moved on to like Telegram, and they moved on to these other websites, and they started accepting Bitcoin instead of Visa and MasterCard.
So they're like celebrity deepfake creators.
Yes. Yes. With like tens of thousands of followers and videos with millions of views.
And then they make their money how now? Just because people pay per view of a thing?
So when you go on to, like, for example, Mr. Deepfakes, the way that it functioned was similar to Pornhub, in that you would watch like a, you could watch like a 5 to 7 minute video. But if you wanted the full hour long scene, you'd have to pay for that. And a lot of them also take requests. So you could pay for a specific woman or celebrity to be deepfaked. And when I went into their forums, the most concerning thing is I saw people wanting to create deepfake material of like their niece or their classmate or their daughter's friend or things like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm not even going to worry about the magical psychic harm, you know, if there is one. But the idea that a young woman's first sexual experience might even be witnessing themselves doing something with someone they don't know in a whatever in a it's odd. Are these generators to the point now where people can go and just type in, "Make me this," you know? Or do you need a professional AI maker?
You definitely don't need a professional AI maker. A lot of young boys are doing this. So I think it requires a certain degree of knowledge beyond just like, here's a picture. But, you know, with Grok, you were seeing it kind of taken to that extreme where it's like, especially with the Grok Imagine tool, which is the standalone Grok app, you could make very violent, very sexually explicit stuff pretty easily with that. And you could input photos privately. So it was even more extreme than what you're seeing with the Grok undressing trend publicly.
Does it make you less... I mean, you're a tech journalist. I mean, we're all this way. And I hate to ask this question because people do it to me all the time. So, oh, you used to be so excited about tech. Now you're so down. You know, as if when we say one cynical, one correcting thing, we're suddenly anti-tech. But you did say AI fills you with dread.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as someone who covers this, you know, what do you want people to understand about AI that they don't?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that there is a real lack of literacy around especially these LLMs and these chatbots, because a lot of people, including journalists, including, you know, journalists who cover technology, there seemingly is a big gap in understanding like how these generators are creating and outputting text. There is like so much of an a desire to humanize them. There is so much of a desire to be like, well, the chatbot says this, like to think that the chatbot is thinking and coming up with original thoughts. And you see that so frequently in headlines. You'll even see people reaching out to Grok for comment. That was something I saw happening. And it's like, I think people don't understand that what the chatbot says to you is based on what you say to it. And so you two different Claude users can ask Claude the same question and get dramatically different answers based on their prior conversation history with the chatbot. So I think any sort of education and literacy around these tools is badly needed. We already saw that lack of literacy with smartphones, with social media, people not understanding the technology leading to misuse and, you know, misinformation about what's happening with the technology.
Yeah. I mean, do you think guardrails are worth anything?
I do. I mean, I think that there are significantly productive things that could be done with these technologies to rein them in, to stop them from saying or doing specific things. I mean, we've seen chatbot companies introducing guardrails around, like, we've even seen OpenAI do this with ChatGPT as users are, you know, inputting suicidal thoughts and the chatbot is encouraging them. You can create a way for the chatbot to be like, we're ending the conversation and directing you to mental health resources. But at the same time, the technology is evolving so quickly that the guardrails are not working fast enough. And in really lengthy conversations, you can easily bypass those guardrails, is what people have found over and over again.
Right. That there's somehow the AI need for sycophancy.
Yes.
Eventually overtakes all other needs, you know, which maybe is a human trait as well. I guess I want to get to the if it's okay with you, the kind of the dark, scary stuff that I mean, I had a few run-ins with, you know, scary people as a result of my work. But I think partly because you're a young woman, mm-hmm. you become I mean, everything, all your work in one way or another, not all of it, but so much of it, and so much of the internet's problems go back to angry, white, sexless men. You know, mm-hmm. this sort of the you know, AI deepfake thing is mostly it's sort of an incel extension.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you covered the Kiwi Farms harassment network. Which maybe you can explain. And it made you a target yourself. So I guess I'm interested to know, what does it cost, you know, practically, personally, and even kind of spiritually to do this kind of work as an independent journalist without some like NBC thing to protect you if they ever did?
Yeah, I think I started encountering sort of harassment and retaliation for my work very early on, especially because when I cover influencers, especially when I cover sort of like negative allegations or controversies involving these online figures, they have online fan bases who are going to attack any sort of opponent or perceived opponent. So that was one of the first things that I encountered was fans of targets of my reporting or just subjects of my reporting who were very irate, who would come after me and you would send me threats, would harass me, would do all of these things. And in the beginning, I was sort of like, this is meaningless. This means nothing to me. Like, whatever. I don't care. I'm not going to listen to that. As time goes on, I think you can kind of see how these consequences can be more impactful. And for example, like I've had so many people try to vandalize my Wikipedia page and they will insert things that say like she's biased. They will insert things like she lied about so-and-so. Wikipedia is very good at actually preventing a lot of this type of harassment from occurring on its platform, but it's not perfect. And elsewhere around the web, you see how this can be more effective. Google SEO, for example, will surface things people have written about you. There was a petition to get me fired, and that was at one point pretty high up in my Google search results. And it's like, stuff like that, you don't even necessarily know how impactful it is, because if someone is thinking about hiring me for a job, or if someone is just looking up information about me and they come across this stuff, you don't even necessarily know it's happened and it could change how people view you. So I think reputational damage is one of the biggest consequences of reporting today. And of course, it especially impacts women. And I think women of color, most of all, have to deal with like these reputational consequences. The actual harassment and death threats for me never escalated to a point where I felt truly unsafe. A lot of my friends in the field have certainly experienced that. I think with going independent, another big threat is sort of the legal liability that you have to carry as a journalist. And so at NBC or at Business Insider, they have in-house lawyers who work for the company who can not only do pre-publication review, but also respond to all the threats you're going to receive. As an independent journalist, I have insurance policies for like errors and omission, but it's a major fear and it's a major threat. And the New York Times business editor David Ehrlich just wrote a book about this last year called Murder the Truth, about these sort of coordinated campaigns against independent journalists. So those are major concerns. I think those are like the biggest things that plague me on a day to day. It requires a certain persistence and a certain sort of ability to withstand backlash in order to do this. And I don't judge people for not being able to handle it. It's not something that's easy to do.
No, it certainly is. And it feels in some ways, just as sort of Gamergate was practice for January 6th.
Yes.
It feels like, you know, harassing a woman writing about internet incels feels like practice for shutting down a journalist exposing the truth about an authoritarian government.
Exactly. Exactly. And I find that, like, we're seeing these smear campaigns grow more and more sophisticated. And one of the things that I've covered a lot over the past few years is how these smear campaigns function. And we don't even know all the answers yet. We don't even know for sure, like, who is a bot, who isn't a bot? What does a bot even mean in this context? Like, are people paying for this stuff? How are they orchestrating it? But what we do know is that there are people out there who are paid very well to orchestrate these types of campaigns online. Their tactics and their success rates are kind of yet to be determined, but the job definitely exists. Like, the fixers are out there.
Yeah, it's weird. In some ways, maybe this is mental illness on my own part, but it feels safer to imagine, oh, this isn't really a person who wants to kill me. This is an orc. Some people in Russia or somewhere, or in at Facebook, orchestrating AIs to say this thing. I mean, I remember for me back in way back, you know, when I had my daughter, like in 2004, which is kind of before this stuff was happening. My daughter is born. My wife put a picture up of the baby picture, and the first comment there, some kind of neo-Nazi guy said, "Oh, she looks like a little kike already." And I was just like, whoa. And that bothered me more to think, because it was probably a human at that point who said that. So, and then I get kind of scared, or the sort of the early 4chan era when they would dox you. It's like, we found his house. We found his car. Here's a picture of his dog. You know? Yeah. Like, oh, fuck. They're coming.
Yeah.
And now maybe it's less real, less harmful, less... I mean, but there's real violence too happening, right? I mean, yes. I guess that's something you've covered. How does, in the early internet days, in the MUDs and stuff, before, who was it, wrote that piece, Richard Gere wrote his piece, The Rape in Cyberspace in 1994 or whatever, we thought the internet would be a safe place for people to go nuts, that they could sort of live out their weird fantasy things. But it turns out that the internet is so connected to the real world that that violence in the cloud hits the ground.
Yes, yes.
How do you make that argument that this is real?
This idea that what happens online isn't real. And even in our casual language, we often say, like, oh, what happens online versus what happens in the real world? Like, people use this framing all the time. I have to catch myself from not using this framing, because I do think that we've moved into a state of being, in a state in our society, where increasingly what happens online is the real world for a lot of people, especially like, I started using smartphones in high school. So I didn't grow I was still a child by the time I began integrating smartphones and social media into my daily life. But there was a period of my childhood that I can remember before all of that. For kids growing up today, this is all they've ever known. And so, of course, digital worlds are very real to them. They don't even have a point of comparison from before digital worlds impacted our reality. But especially when you look at, like, people get their news on social media, people get feedback on social media, even our beauty standards have evolved to reflect what is popular online versus what is popular offline. So I think that at this point, there's really not as much of a gap. And that can be really dangerous, because things online can obviously be inauthentic and distorted. But now those distortions reflect on and cause real consequences in our physical offline settings.
Right. I mean, it's also, I mean, if it is your social life, if it is, you know, it's an extension of our neurology at this point.
And people have entire relationships online. People have entire relationships. They fall in love with people and they never even see them in real life. So in that sense, you can see how online functions can be very, very real world functions.
Right. But it also, I mean, there's actual physical violence that happens too. I mean,
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many acts of terror stem from these online situations. At this point, I think 4chan has been linked to several far-right terrorist attacks, manifestos, even the shooting of Charlie Kirk on the bullets were inscribed these very online phrases. And the killer, you know, told all of his friends on Discord what he had done after it happened. So there is this massive escalation, particularly, I think, around violence stemming from some of these online radical echo chambers.
Where do you, you know, point us, whether it's, you know, government or people or builders, toward sort of mitigating the harm? I've always tried to do like media literacy, but media literacy seems to have failed, you know? They're all the ones who say, do the research, you know, they just deconstruct everything and become conspiracy theorists.
Yeah. My early years spent online as a teenager led me down a very different path than some of these, for example, young men who are spending time on places like 4chan, like Kiwi Farms. Those websites are extreme. They are echo chambers and they are conduits for harassment. You also have alternatives. I grew up and I spent a lot of time in my teenage years on Tumblr. And on Tumblr, there was a lot of social justice activism happening.
Right.
So that was how I learned about feminism. And that was how I learned about social justice and progress and LGBTQ identity and all of these really, really great things. And I think that, to me, I almost view them as like two sides of the same coin, where it's like you had a big population of young men becoming radicalized in a conservative direction in some parts of the internet. And then you had a big group of young women becoming more radicalized in a liberal progressive direction on other sides of the internet. So there is a way to harness these tools for social progress. But I think the incentive structure is completely broken, because on platforms, on all the major social platforms today, you are disincentivized from posting about things that lend themselves toward political or human or progressive progress. You are more incentivized to make people angry, to make people confused. Like, all of those very antisocial behaviors are what the platforms have incentivized in order to, of course, keep people online longer, keep them engaged, keep them consuming advertisements.
And then so what, I don't even know how to ask this. It's like, I was going to kind of ask, what do you do for fun? But in a way, that is the question. So, you know, I know you are working with Digital Void for a while with our producer, Josh,
yes.
You know, which was a really exciting project to me, because it's like, wait a minute, people are in a nightclub watching speakers do PowerPoint presentations about memes and culture and society. So it starts to feel like, I mean, maybe to some listeners, this has been a wonky conversation. But on the other hand, there's whether you're looking at, you know, the Culture Journal and Josh Citarella and Matt Klein, mm-hmm. there's people playing and thinking in this area, not, I don't mean just as entertainment, but as almost an artistic, literary, cultural practice. And it seems to me, if what we're doing can feel as cool and fun and irreverent as like Dime Square did
right.
for the right-wing kids before, then we have a chance, right? So I'm wondering, I get the feeling like you're involved, you're going places like on Avenue C where weird shit's happening.
Yeah, I mean, over the past year in particular, I've been doing significantly more of these types of live events, and some in New York City, but also around the country and even beyond. So like, I have friends who have grown big YouTube or podcast audiences, and something that's become more popular is taking those things on tour. And so I've been a part of several of these, like, you could loosely call them podcast tours, but they don't always follow that format. It's more just like opportunities to take people's online audiences and put them in a physical room and see what happens. And
right.
a lot of times what happens is like it's very fun and it's very community based and it feels very different from watching someone on a live stream versus like actually physically being in a room with them and surrounded by like-minded people. So I've been seeing more and more of that lately, and I suspect we'll be seeing a lot more of it, because I think people really crave in-person socializing again. Like, in a since 2020, this whole generation only knows socializing, you know, allegedly, through their computer screen, through their phone screen. I don't think that's entirely true, but people are looking for ways to connect in person, one-on-one, or in these big group settings. And so harnessing internet attention and turning it into real life events seems like one way to do that that's becoming more popular.
Right. I mean, and so you see, like, there's a podcast I had, True and On, right?
Yes.
They do these national tours.
Yes.
And they fill theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And then they find a local guest and they platform the local person. And it's like, there's something really good about that. But it's funny, not to end where we started, but that's what the Humans First movement is doing, is saying, okay, there's a lot of people online.
Yes.
There's a sort of a groundswell. Why don't we create some real world events and bring people in a room and have us galvanize?
And I will say, like, I had a critical eye when I was looking at the organization, because I was like, what are they sort of like not telling us? But I loved actually being in that town hall and getting to talk with people about AI technology. It was so refreshing to have conversations face to face with strangers from diverse backgrounds about how they are utilizing this technology. And from those conversations, as someone who doesn't use a lot of AI technology, I was like, oh, there are some interesting uses for this that I hadn't even thought of that are very compelling to me. For example, I spoke to, not at the Humans First event, but I spoke to another digital culture journalist and writer recently, and she brought up how with the Claude coding capabilities, it's so much easier to make your own website now. And so this presents a huge opportunity for young people and really anyone to be able to build their own platforms. And I was like, oh, well, I do like that idea. Like, that is a very compelling idea to me. So I think all of that to say, getting people to talk about these things at length, face to face, there's so much benefit there. And it did feel really nice. It felt like more of a social event, like, for lack of a better term, like, it felt like putting humans first.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least life first, you know, earthlings.
Yes.
Earthlings for, I feel bad for all the little things we're killing and the big things we're killing, you know, for all in the name of humans first. But that's all right. That's first. It's a, you know, America first. I get it. It makes them feel comfortable talking about humans. Otherwise, it gets so soft and squishy, right? You know, the other thing I'm seeing in real life now are sort of AI vibe coding meetups and things. You know, I started doing one with a bunch of people. You know, Ben Wong from Meta Crisis in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
He started this thing, doing it in the back of Caravan of Dreams on East 6th Street on Sundays. You know, on Sunday afternoon, you get 30, 40 people in there vibe coding, you know, learning how, oh, you're putting Claude on their desktop. And, you know, and I started out, I guess, because so many of my listeners are just anti-AI from the get. It's just bad.
Yeah.
Right? And in some ways, it is just bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the energy and the slavery, you know, but your iPhone's just bad in that sense. I mean, how many AI prompts would it take to buy one iPhone or get one iPhone upgrade? You know, so we've got to sort of balance what we're doing.
Yeah.
But I'm seeing people build, you know, platforms and sharing. They want to do a couch surfing for everything.
Right.
You know, build it. Go for it. Take you the Amazon killer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, as someone who's been so critical of AI, I have to say, like, one thing that really heartened me was seeing a bunch of young people build these AI tools to sort through the Epstein files, to like parse through these massive data dumps and find information. I'm like, well, how can I argue with that? I think that is like a great utility of this tool. And yes, you could do it with people, but it would take longer at a time when it's politically expedient to be able to gather as much of this information as possible. And they've been able to build, you know, there's the whole like, look like you're in Jeffrey Epstein's email, where you can actually log onto a website and you're in his email and you can navigate through it. It's such an interesting way of displaying that data and information. So I do think, as much as I have been critical of AI and will continue to be very critical of AI, I also think that I don't want to write it off completely, because I've already seen some like more positive utilities with these technologies.
Are you going on the road? Are you doing talks and things? Can people come? Are you going to do a book?
Not yet, but there will be more things down the road of that variety. For now, SpitfireNews.com, my newsletter, that's where people can find me. And hopefully soon I will have more to announce.
And has Spitfire yet become as remunerative as NBC?
It's not there yet, but it has been very encouraging. And as of right now, I'm sort of cobbling it together with a bunch of random gigs, as many people in my generation have to do. And I'm very optimistic about the future of it. I will say, like, the start and the first year of Spitfire has been really, really positive. And I'm really grateful for all the people who have turned out for me.
Yeah, it's a great name. It's a great name for
you.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like, and it's also, it's like it feels pre-defended. It's like, it doesn't feel vulnerable. It's just like, what are you going to do? She's a Spitfire.
Right.
You can't fuck with that, you know?
Right.
It's just like, there's so much energy coming out of it that you can't, like, you think of how to, there's no victimhood in it, right?
Yeah. I was inspired by Jezebel, the feminist vlogging platform, because I love that concept of taking a term that's been used in a derogatory sense and sort of reclaiming it and being like, I'm actually proud of that aspect of myself. So I'm glad that you like the name.
Oh yeah, definitely. And everyone should go and support. It's a Beehive, not a Substack, right?
Right.
Yeah, because we don't like Substack.
I went with Beehive largely because I saw so many of my peers leave Substack after the big Nazi scandal that has happened over the past few years.
Yeah, then why start, right?
Exactly.
Why start in with that? I know. Platforms.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many. Can't live with them. Can't live without them.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much. I'm really, thanks for what you do. I mean, I would say you're a more rigorous internet journalist than I am, but you're coming up in a time when more rigor is called for. You know, back in the 90s, nobody knew what was going on, you know? And it wasn't until like 99 or 2000 that it was like applying rigor was really just saying, I don't think the AOL Time Warner merger is such a good thing.
Right.
You know, that was like, oh my God, how dare he say that? You know, attack, attack.
Yeah.
So back then it was like, but now, man, I'm glad you're there. And hopefully one of the things that you'll be announcing, not immediately, but eventually, is having a bunch of other writers there, you know, to a network, because no one wants to be truly alone. You could be the next whatever, ProPublica, Associated Press, you know, a network of Spitfires out there.
Absolutely. That's the goal.
Spitting fire. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Well, great. Well, thank you. Everybody go to, what do they just go to? Spitfirenews.com. Spitfirenews.com. That'll take you to our Beehive. And you can find everything else from there. Thanks so much for everything, for being on Team Human and for what you do, and keeping the tradition. And so people don't realize what it even is, but this is what journalism is, believe it or not. This is what journalism, it's not pontificating on late night cable. It's this. It's actually breaking stories, taking risks, figuring things out, talking to real people, leaving the computer and going into the world. That's how it happens. So thanks so much for doing that.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And thank you, everybody, for being on Team Human. You can support us, too, by the clicking on things and liking things. There's hearts. There's checks. There's sends. There's, you know, there's all those things, reviews. Do whatever, because we're on all these platforms. I can't say what. But do whatever it is encouraging that helps us. And if you really, really, really want to help, go to patreon.com/teamhuman and give us some love in the form of financial support. And you get to then not just come to the premieres we're doing on YouTube, but then the discussions we're having after the premieres in Patreon. They're really fun. We're going to be doing some live events soon. And you get the ad-free version of the show, which who doesn't want that? Even though our advertisers are actually, we get special nice ones from the good side of the planet. So thanks, everybody. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.